Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Kevin, let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Today on the show, we are taking another look at something outside our standard content. We are going to talk to some of the leaders in surgery that are involved in social media and learn how they have used social media to learn about surgery and to connect with others in the surgery world. So we have a really exciting panel today, and Dr. Steele is going to introduce them here.
So welcome, everybody, to another edition of Behind the Knife, and we are very excited today to touch on a subject that is near and dear to our hearts, and that's the use of social media, and specifically the use of social media in surgery. We have a wonderful guest panel that we're very excited to have, and first of all, we have Dr. Edward Livingston, who was a general surgeon and bariatric surgeon, but he's the deputy editor of clinical content for all of the JAMA articles, or all the JAMA magazines. Next, we have Scott Ruggenbogen, who is an assistant professor of surgery and is the chief of the Division of Colorectal Surgery at the University of Michigan. He's also a social media committee member for the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons. We also have Amalia Cochran, who's at the University of Utah. She's a burn and critical care surgeon. She's the vice chair of education and professionalism for the Department of Surgery. She's the president-elect for the Association of Women Surgeons. And as a part of her other duties, she serves as the web and the social media editor for JAMA Surgery. And to round out the panel, we have Dr. Lillian Cao, who is a professor of the Department of Surgery at the Division of Acute Care Surgery at UT Health. She's the recent past president of the Association for Academic Surgery, and she also serves as a social media editor for the Journal of American College of Surgeons. Welcome, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us today here on Behind the Knife.
Thank you for having us all. Thanks for having us.
So, Lil, I'm going to start out with you. Tell me a little bit about how do you feel that social media, and not so much your role in terms of the Journal of American College of Surgeons, but how do you feel social media fits into the world of academic surgery today?
I think that social media plays an important role in helping to disseminate research. I think that it changes the way that researchers communicate with each other and even collaborate with each other. In particular, I first became introduced to social media at the Academic Surgical Congress in 2013. In fact, Amalia was one of the people who first introduced me to social media. And I found that the entire way that I viewed the meeting changed because of Twitter and how people were tweeting content of parts of the meeting that they were attending. And even I changed the way that I was listening to presentations so that I could try to capture meanings into 140 character phrases.
Scott, I'll turn that question over to you next. How do you feel that social media is involved in surgery today?
I think, like a lot of us, I was a very reluctant entrant into the world of social media. I had the idea that it was meant for millennials and that I wasn't one of them. But I think what convinced me was friends who showed me that it can be a really efficient way to have almost a reader's digest of whatever it is you're interested in. So what I found was all you need to do is find half a dozen or a dozen people who read a lot more widely than you do, but have interests in what you're interested in, and perhaps are even maybe a little bit smarter in some of the things you wish you knew more about. And if you follow those people and keep track of what they're reading, I could very quickly have access to a whole realm of information that I otherwise might have missed out on. And I very quickly became, you know, an avid follower of, you know, again, half a dozen to 10 people who now set my academic agenda.
Amalia, we'll just continue to go around the horn.
I was a little less reluctant to embrace social media, as you can tell from Lillian mentioning that I was one of the instigators of us having a Twitter team at the Academic Surgical Congress a few years ago. One of the things that really strikes me about social media in our profession in this day and age is I am mystified how people do manage to keep up with our field without having Twitter or some sort of aggregator like this. That's really one of the critical ways I use it. There's the obvious social networking aspect of it, too, that's purely social, but it, as Scott said, it's such an amazing resource for keeping up with new publications, the fact that all of our major journals now have social media editors speaks volumes to that, because what that does is it allows the journals to push out their highest impact content in a way that we can find that without having to monkey around with going through the table of contents. I agree completely with Scott's point about following people who are probably smarter than we are and getting their insights into things. That is incredibly helpful.
And Dr. Livingston, you're obviously as the, talking about clinical content and at the JAMA level, how do you feel it fits into surgery today?
So I'm fairly new to it, but I've made the transition from full-time academic surgeon to full-time journal editor. And as a journal editor, I worry a lot, think a lot about how people communicate and how we communicate through the journal to our readers. And in the modern era, that's clearly through social media, and that's how people are communicating. What I found interesting about it is the massive amount of interaction and communication that's now possible that was never possible before. And you see the kinds of conversations occurring on social media and blogs and websites that are really, truly remarkable. So I think in terms of what it does for surgery, by increasing that communication and discussion, it will greatly improve the quality of surgical care, just because now, when you've got a problem and you're maybe in the operating room or the clinic, you're not exactly sure what to do with it, instead of sort of guessing and moving on, you can tweet it, and within a few minutes, you'll have answers. So I think it's a remarkable tool that will improve everything that we do.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for those great open comments. This is John, and I want to start off the discussion with taking a look at the different platforms we use for social media. You know, we all know the typical platforms, Twitter, Facebook, Doximity, and LinkedIn. And, my question for the group is, what is the best use for each type of these platforms, and how do you feel today's surgeons are using them?
I've found that people tend to use them in very different ways. When I sort of straw polled colleagues, and we even did a straw poll at the JAMA Surgery Editorial Board meeting not too long ago, a lot of people use Facebook for, as Sherry Wren puts it, dog videos or cat videos. And that tends to be more purely friends, family, more personally directed than a lot of people use their other social media tools from a professional standpoint. A lot of us have confessed to our Twitterites that we have greater than one Twitter account, that we've got a professional profile and a personal profile. I certainly do that. Doximity has been really interesting to me because at least at my institution, a lot of the use of Doximity is really centered around needing to have people on Doximity to improve the hospital and the health science center's rankings. And so it makes it a little harder for me to figure out what to do with Doximity other than I know I'm supposed to be a member, so I'm a good department member. And then, of course, LinkedIn. LinkedIn has changed a little bit in the last year because historically, I think a lot of people used it as more of a job search tool, and now there's people that you can follow and who are influencers, and it's become a very different sort of environment that may, over time, serve to address professional development more thoroughly. So that's sort of my view from 20,000 feet of kind of the big four.
And my second question is also for the group. Which ones have you found to be the most effective?
I think it depends on what you're trying to accomplish in terms of effectiveness. I, like Amalia, have used Facebook primarily for social reasons, to connect with friends, whereas Twitter is more of a professional account for me. And I would say that Twitter is probably good for reaching a large number of people with just sort of a brief tagline or kind of a sort of catchphrase, kind of like hashtag I look like a surgeon, and that can catch on very quickly, whereas I think Facebook allows for a little bit more in-depth commentary because it allows you more than 140 characters. And then I think as far as professional networking, perhaps Doximity and LinkedIn are more useful there.
Scott, I'm curious if you would touch base a little bit about the use of the personal side of Twitter versus the professional side of Twitter. I've followed you along on a lot of your posts, and it's very interesting. Sometimes you'll post something about a great article or something that's going on in society or something you have, and then sometimes it's just something about what's going on in your personal life. I heard Amalia talk a little bit about having a professional Twitter or maybe a personal side. How do you blend the two?
I think I'm very conscious of who might be listening, and I'm well aware that whatever I put on Twitter is going to be read by anyone who follows me. And that's a little bit of an obligation to make sure that I don't say things that would bore them, that say things that would distract them. And so, I would say my personal comments are kept to a relative minimum, and they're usually things that I think the people who follow me on Twitter would, might be interested in hearing. I try not to tell people what I had for dinner. And I think I generally just think about who's listening. And so I think that my favorite thing about Twitter is the opportunity to potentially say something provocative and hear what other people have to say. So recently, I've been troubled by some articles that maybe question what I do clinically, and I have loved putting it out there and seeing if anybody else does the same things I do.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Dr. Livingston, from your kind of big breath view, from somebody who's in charge of clinical content, obviously you have to be wary about maybe what you say or what you don't say. How do you balance this in terms of your job versus your personal opinion, and how do you feel these different platforms play a role into maybe what the JAMA articles or what the JAMA magazines themselves might have to say?
Well, the different platforms have different purposes, as was outlined before. We primarily concentrate on Twitter and Facebook at the journal. Twitter obviously is a good way to just let people know where there's content somewhere else through a link. And Facebook is pretty good for posting images and also directing people somewhere else. But most of the journals have concentrated on Twitter just because you reach such a vast audience and with a relatively small number of tweets. So in terms of personal versus professional, I'm sort of new to this. I don't really get into the personal aspects of it. I don't really maintain a personal account. In terms of what I put out there professionally, I'll put out a lot of content from the journals. But also, I feel that as a journal editor that has a different perspective on things, I will every once in a while comment on something that people are talking about just to sort of get perspective. And I've gotten into some what I call Twitter dogfights with reporters and all that, most recently with the ProPublica people, which are very public. Everything we do at JAMA, there's such a huge audience that we have to be careful about everything that we say or do, and you're kind of used to that. But on the other hand, you need to be provocative, you need to stimulate thought, you need to get information out there, so you can't be too conservative.
No, I guess going along with that, professionalism and your social media, there was a recent article by Dr. Sean Langenfeld, on unprofessional behavior on Facebook among practicing surgeons. Now, he published one in 2014. We looked at mainly just residents and looked at their Facebook accounts and determined whether they're unprofessional or they're professional based on a rating system he developed. And he recently did one on staff surgeons alone. He found that, obviously staff surgeons tend to have a more professional Facebook accounts than the residents themselves, and the ones they did find that were unprofessional were usually those that haven't been practicing for less than 5 years. Now, can anybody expand on what's that line you need to walk with being professional on the social media, and how can that hurt you in your career?
I guess I would just say that, as I said before, I'm very conscious of who the audience is for anything that I say. And I'm well aware that the people who are listening include people who I have a lot of respect for. And so I, very much separate what I say to them from what I might say to friends or family. And I think where people have gotten into trouble around revealing health protected health information, I think that's simply people forgetting the difference between you know, what they say in their social lives and what they should say related to their job. And I think that for the most part, we just need to remember that what we say online is very much the same as anything we'd say in an elevator or in a hallway, and needs to have all the same appropriateness and be subject to all the same limitations, and remembering that we wear our profession on our sleeve no matter where we are.
I have a quick question. This is Kevin. Has anyone had any of their patients actually reach out to them or mention that they are following them on these different platforms?
I never have.
No. I don't know if I have patients who follow me on Twitter or not. I have a few of my former patients who I am Facebook friends with, a handful. I think it's 3 or 4. And I have a very clear policy that if someone is currently a patient in our burn unit, they are actively undergoing treatment, that I will refuse friend requests from them or their family members, simply because I think those things do get too messy and too sticky. And it's not like I put a lot of stuff about work on my Facebook account. I put virtually nothing about work on my Facebook account other than links to my blog posts, because I have friends who are not in medicine who still enjoy reading them. But I feel very strongly about maintaining some sort of boundary there. And the folks who I am Facebook friends with who are former patients are people who, quite honestly, I feel like if I had met them socially, I would probably be friends with them. And it just happens that they had the misfortune to end up in my care.
I want to go back to a little bit about something that Dr. Livingston said. You said you got in a little bit of a back and forth between various people, whether it be on Twitter or any one of the other accounts. Have you ever had anybody from within the JAMA organization say something to you like, hey, tone it down, or has any, and then to the group as well, has anybody come back and said, hey, you know, I saw something that you posted and maybe want to back that off?
No, not yet, but I'm waiting. We're a very conservative organization, and I think I've been the only one full-timer who's really gotten very proactive with a public persona on social media. Our editor-in-chief, Howard Bachner, would send out tweets when he first started at JAMA under the name of JAMA, not identify himself. I've come out as myself. Mm-hmm. So we're just sort of waiting for something to blow up. But so far, no one has said anything to me.
Any of the other group, has anybody ever had anybody kind of at work discuss what you are posting or mention, say, hey, would you post something for me?
I have not had anybody say that to me. I get more comments on my blog posts than on things that relate to Twitter or Facebook from folks at work or folks out there in the ether, in terms of people commenting about things I write on the blog and, you know, how it resonated with them or whatever that may have been. So that's really where I tend to feel like I get more of that.
At JAMA, we're looking for ways to interact with our readers, and we've been working for a long time on a mechanism to have comments on articles so that we can interact with them by that mechanism. So the discussions in social media are really an extension of that. So I think that most of the people at the journal like the idea of interacting with the readers, and we're just now starting to actually do it.
And is that somebody that is specific to the journal that might have that role, or is it primarily been you to date, or where do you see that particular interaction winding up?
Well, the two things. One, journal-wide, we're developing a mechanism. We do have a mechanism available for some of the JAMA Network specialty journals where readers can comment, and those comments are edited by an editor or an author. We don't have that functionality for JAMA yet. We're in the process of building a new website, which will be out next year, and it will have that functionality. So it's something that everybody wants. We just don't have it yet. And so I've I've sort of taken a leap ahead. I've been very anxious. I am the, as the clinical editor, I'm the person who's supposed to figure out what readers want and how they interpret our information. And so this has been very informative for me to see through social media what people are saying about our content. And quite frankly, a lot of it has been eye-opening and surprising to read how people interpret studies that we put out there that we think very differently about them.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, in terms of comments on Twitter and a link to, for example, a PubMed citation, Amalia and I are both involved in something called the International General Surgery Journal Club, where we pick an article each month. We invite an author who's active on Twitter as well as a moderator, and then we devote 2 days to discussing the article. And you can actually link the Journal Club comments to the PubMed citation. So there is a way for social media comments to make it to an official citation.
Yeah, Lily, I'd be curious a little bit more about that. So are you vetting these particular comments, or are you going back and saying, or does somebody from the PubMed side of the house be able to go back, or how does that actually work in process?
In order for people to be able to comment, they have to be a registered user on PubMed comments. So this doesn't necessarily work like the comment section in your local newspaper that I think strikes terror into all of our hearts. Rather, the comments are, you know, publicly identifiable because you've got your PubMed Commons ID on them. And as far as I understand, there is not a moderating mechanism, although the authors can certainly go and rebut the comments that are posted there.
Yeah, usually all the comments are not listed verbatim. It's more of a summary of the commentary that occurred. And Amalia has also, for the Journal Club, done something like used a program or app such as Storify and together in a more cohesive manner to make it sound like a story, so that if one question gets tweeted but you get responses at different times of the day, you can group them all together to make it sound like a more cogent discussion. And then that can be made available to people as a transcript.
To take this conversation in a little different direction, this is Kevin. In our generation, we don't do anything without looking at a review site. We don't go to dinner or go to a movie without seeing what other people reviewed it. And now this is becoming very pertinent in the medical world. And I was wondering, I'll direct this question to Dr. Cowell to get started. And I know it's a little different because we have a group of academic surgeons here rather than private practice that would maybe be more in the marketing, but how do you see social media in the role in marketing yourself for your practice, and how do you plan on handling these review sites? It seems like there's numerous ones that will have a few ratings of you based on only about 5 patients at this point in time.
I think that it's a reality and that we all have to think about how we deal with it. I personally have not had a lot of experience I work at a county hospital. But I'm sure that it's coming. I would say that it's just another layer that we, you know, patient satisfaction, everything is patient-oriented, and I think we have to think about that. I personally have not marketed clinical services on social media, but I would say that academic surgeons, when they're tweeting about their work and commenting on other people's work, are in a way marketing themselves as researchers, because people can they can have some sort of impression about you in terms of your insight, your level of knowledge, who asks you for feedback. I mean, all of that goes into a perception of how you are as a researcher and an academician.
Dr. Livingston, can you comment in terms of marketing the journal or JAMA in general? Do you feel social media or any of the different platforms are a way that you can get that word out and talk about what you're doing?
Well, it's actually considered essential in publishing now, that this is one of the more important ways of disseminating information. And if you're not in the social media space, you're bound to go the way of Sears or something and just not exist anymore. So actually when Howard Bachner took over JAMA a few years ago, he created two positions that he thought were necessary to propel the journal into the future. One of them was my position, the clinical editor, to keep a pulse of what clinicians want from the journal. And the other was a digital editor. And there's one of my colleagues of mine, another deputy editor, Mike Berkowitz, who is a full-time, spends his full time developing our presence on social media. So from a journal and publishing perspective, it's a space you absolutely have to be in.
Scotty, can you mention a little bit about something about how these, it seems like, you know, maybe it's an offspring or a little bit off from Twitter or Doximity or Facebook, but we have all these health grades and, all, you know, vitals. And it seems like you, like, there's all these different sites that pop up that talk about you as a surgeon or somebody who may or may not have known you. Where do you see that kind of coming up? Do you have any experience with that? And do you have any kind of advice for people out there about populating those sites? Should we be doing that as surgeons? Should we be saying, hey, listen, let's get our name, let's get ahead of this, and so we're not just responding to maybe one or two negative feedback?
Yeah, I was struck by Kevin's comment about, you know, that there's a generation who looks up everything online, and, you know, there's more discussion of Yelp for physicians and how we might find physician ratings online. In general, I've found that the ratings of myself, if I've ever looked at them, are pretty skimpy and don't offer really all that much information. But I've often wondered, if I wasn't in an academic institution and I was really trying to build a business for myself, to what degree I might pay a lot more attention to that. My only experience with real ratings and how it might affect anyone was actually my wife, who's an OBGYN, and had a single person mention that, you know, if you go to this doctor, you're going to get a C-section. And she found that for the next year, she had this unbelievable number of patients who came to her and asked her exactly that question. And it wasn't until halfway through the year that she finally figured out where this was coming from. So there's no question that people are reading these reviews. It's not totally clear what we should, as physicians, should do about them. I think most of us are somewhat uncomfortable marketing ourselves or responding to reviews the way that a hotel manager might, but it's clearly going to be a way that people get information about us, and it's probably our obligation to keep track of that to some degree and do our best to make sure that we're presented the way we'd want to have ourselves presented.
You know, that's an excellent point, and I will just say one of my limited experience of people who had a interesting aspect is they had an ex-girlfriend go on one of these vitals or one of these other sites and put a very negative review on there. And there is mechanisms in place to get these reviews reversed, but it's important to think about these things and get ahead of them. And I'd be curious, I'd go back to Amalia or Lillian, have you, either of you, gone to any of these sites, checked yourself out? We always ask, do you Google yourself? Have you checked yourself out on vitals.com or MD Health Reports or any of these ones out there? And have you populated this stuff yourself so that you can control the information that's being sent to the public?
Personally, I have not. I say that with a little asterisk next to it. And the reason that I say that is because University of Utah has gotten a lot of national recognition for the fact that our medical group hits our press gaming force online. And so if you go to my profile at the University of Utah, you can see my press gaming force. And you can see them for all of my colleagues. And they did this with the idea of taking control of the narrative of who we are and what we're doing. This has largely been a very successful experiment. I know from talking to the physician director of our medical group that there have been some of the groups that have pushed back against it. But by and large, it's been very successful and it's been highly touted. And so while I have not gone and looked at myself other places, I've seen my press gaming scores because they're there if I go to my page with the university. I don't really feel pressed to go look at my scores anywhere, and I think Lillian is similar since she's a trauma acute care surgeon. Our practice consists of whoever rolls through the door. And with that being the case, since we are not referral-based surgeons, it doesn't give me carte blanche to be a terrible human being to my patients. In fact, I would argue quite the opposite. Sometimes they need more empathy. But it means that I I lose a little less sleep over those issues, I suppose.
So I can comment on this because I spent my academic career as a bariatric surgeon. And the bariatric patient community has had internet-based chat rooms forever. And for most of the years that I was engaged in practice, they were there. And people said lots, you know, that's a very difficult population to deal with. I was in a referral practice. So I was often saying no to patients. They'd get upset. They didn't like their outcomes. So I had a lot of very negative comments on the internet about me. And all you could do, you can't control it. All you can do is try to have a response when patients come and ask you about what they read about you online. So you need to know what is said about you online and be prepared to respond to it. But I don't know that you can or should change your practice because of what occurs online. And I know if you Google me, my kids love this. They say, Dad, you're such an a-hole. Just have to Google you and see what people say about you. But I always had a very full clinic, and people take all that with a grain of salt. Kind of like, you know, if you're committed to having a BMW and you go online and you read a Consumer Reports thing that says they're crappy cars, you're still going to buy one if that's what you want. So people take all that with a grain of salt, and you just have to be prepared to explain things to them when they come to your clinic.
Dr. Steele, I actually just looked you up on healthgrades.com, and you've done very well. You have a 5-star rating average. The only thing you've been dinged for is your staff friendliness and courteousness. So I think that, and that's based on one review.
Well, you need to go back a few years and look at some of the old ones from when I was at UCLA. My children can tell you exactly where those exist.
Now, I guess going along with that same theme on how we get our information and looking up things online, I mean, how do we deal with that patient, you know, is sitting there Googling their disease or Googling their diagnosis when you're telling it to them, and how do you deal with it when the information is inaccurate?
Dr. Regabung, how would you deal with this situation?
Yeah, I think that's very common. We see that a lot in inflammatory bowel disease patients in particular. They're often young, they're often savvy. They have a chronic disease, and there's all kinds of information online, which ranges from the incredibly helpful to the incredibly crazy. And so we face this all the time. I think the best we can do is try to, you know, differentiate between what we know from good clinical science and what we can only sort of speculate about based on anecdote. And I try to make a pretty clear difference between those. I try to, if people are really heavily weighted towards anecdote, I try to then weight towards my own anecdote and my own experience and what I can tell them about what I've seen. You know, likely to be successful and what's not likely to be successful. I've offered for some people to, you know, read the same websites they read and let them know what I think. I've had relatively few people who've been unwilling to engage in that conversation. I think there's usually a recognition that the that while what's online may be novel and may be counterculture, that it's not subject to the same degree of scrutiny as what we read elsewhere.
Now, along with that, is there any good recommendations from the group of, you know, good places to get information for patients or to direct patients to for, you know, the variety of disease processes?
I'm not sure that I know exactly where patients should go to search for information. I do know that, for example, on Twitter, if you're looking for tweets on a specific healthcare topic, there is something called the Healthcare Hashtag Project, which tries to use a uniform hashtag for specific diseases so that people can who tweet about it can get their comments filed under that hashtag. And similarly, people searching for information on a topic like colon cancer can find it using a hashtag. So there are ways that it may be easier, but none of that is necessarily vetted just because it's under the hashtag.
Kind of sticking with that same information and education theme, Ed, can you talk a little bit about, you mentioned earlier about how readers read a specific article and you're amazed a little bit about what they took away from it. Can you tell us a little bit more about that process, how you may see this expanding, and is there a way you can use social media to give your readers a behind-the-scenes view about a particular article?
Yeah. So let me tell you a story and how I found you guys. We published this article on appendicitis, which was a randomized controlled trial comparing antibiotic to surgical therapy. And as you all know, that was a very controversial article and generated a lot of discussion. That was about the time I entered social media. And in the discussions in social media, it was very apparent to me that many aspects of the study were misinterpreted by the people who were talking about it. They just didn't understand why certain things were done the way they were, and then they would criticize, you know, too much antibiotics, too many days in the hospital. They didn't really understand why those things were done. I really didn't anticipate that when I edited that paper, but that was a very consistent, there were the types of criticisms of the paper were very consistent, and I only saw that in social media. And that was a real eye-opener for me, because I had my beliefs about that paper, but found that we really needed to find a way to communicate the issues differently. And so we're talking about that at the journal, whether we try to take that on through social media and have maybe a chat about it or write another paper, an editorial or whatever. But it's been really interesting to get that sort of immediate feedback on what people think about an article, whereas in the past, we really had no way to know when we put articles out there what people thought about them or what they did with them.
So do you think that in the future there will be that interaction between kind of a behind-the-scenes look at the paper, like what maybe some of the things that came out in a particular article or reasons why you give feedback, for example, to authors who submit a particular manuscript to your journal, and to get that feedback in addition to the reviewer feedback of why or why not that was a good study? Are we going to go that far?
Yeah, we are. I mean, I really want to have a way that we could have ongoing communications about papers that are published in the literature. And those, so for example, we'd like to have a better defined process than what we currently have for fielding the sort of critiques that came about that paper. So we probably should have had a chat functionality on the JAMA website. We don't currently have that. We should have had the authors and editors answering questions people had about the paper. And that is something that we're building into our new systems, and it's something we certainly want to do. And currently, and as I mentioned, we published this thing a couple months ago or less, and that's really when I got immersed in social media. And now it's, you know, Twitter is worse than crack. So once you get started on it, you can't stop. So I'm spending a lot of time on Twitter, but it's extremely helpful. It's from an editor's perspective, extremely useful. And we are trying to find ways to have an ongoing dialogue between readers, authors, and editors.
Scott, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about social media and communication with the patients. I know that we have web portals that are secure that people can log into, and here at University Hospitals in Cleveland, and just talk a little bit about MyUHCare as one of these ones. I'm sure a lot of different hospitals have them, but are we that far away from communicating with our patients directly through social media and having a Scott Regenbotten's, you know, crew of colorectal patients out there, a blog or a Facebook or a private logged in one where they can only see some things that you communicate directly with your patients? Are we going to get there?
I mean, at the most superficial level, if I started getting a lot of communications directly from patients, that might chase me off of Twitter pretty quickly. You know, I think it would very much undermine what I've been using it for. On the other hand, I expressed a little bit of my challenge in trying to respond to and correct what I think are misinformed patients getting information off the internet. So you could easily put that back to me as a bit of an obligation to find a way to provide the right information. And I can certainly imagine that a web portal of some kind would be a great way to control the flow in and out of information. It's not something I've contemplated investing in, but as we strive to empower our patients more and more and give them access to information and give them access to the ability to be independent, it would be great to be able to control the flow of information. And I could very much imagine giving them access to something like that. Haven't really contemplated doing it myself.
Alia, one of your many duties is as the web and the social media editor for JAMA Surgery. Can you talk a little bit about kind of how your role fits in there, how you develop content for each of these, and how you, I don't want to use control the content, but how do you get that interaction with everybody out there to make sure that it's, number one, correct, and number two, that you can have a free-form discussion about people's opinions?
We're definitely still working on the piece about generating discussion, as Ed has already very eloquently outlined. We are looking at exploring some new directions right now because we recognize that an important piece of this is about the dialogue. We really have such a great opportunity to bring people in to meaningful content that's out there, and social media gives us a way to entice them by putting that shiny object that they're going to click on out there, so to speak. And I'm not saying that in a clickbait sort of sense. I'm really saying it and give them that figure from the article that really includes the take-home point, and they look at it and they think, wow, that's pretty interesting. And they'll click through and look at the article or, pick a image that relates to it in some way. So a lot of my role for the last 8 months since I took on that position has really been trying to help attract readers, but also potentially, non-readers who become readers to our material. And now we're working on what I really consider to be phase two, which is moving to how do we turn this into a dialogue effectively. And that is a more challenging discussion, I think, at the level of the journal. I don't think it's insurmountable. I think that tools like Tweet Chat, I think tools like author interviews are options that are helpful. We've certainly seen that with the International General Surgery Journal Club on Twitter. The level of dialogue that we've been able to have there, I will openly confess that one of my favorite International General Surgery Journal Clubs involves Scott, where we talked about his article on diverticulitis that came out last year. That's been a really fun way to engage, and I think that's the direction you're going to see a lot of us going.
Dr. Cochran, as one of the more prolific surgeons in social media, I was hoping you could give a little intro to some of our listeners out there that are new to social media. They have a Facebook account, but they're not really on Twitter. And I can speak from experience. Twitter is a little intimidating at first. You don't really know what a retweet is versus a favorite versus whether it's appropriate to comment toward senior physicians. Can you just give a little intro to the person out there that wants to get involved, and specifically to Twitter, how to get involved and not just get involved and just subscribe to people, but to actually become an active user? And because I think that's where it becomes fun, and that's where getting involved really makes it worthwhile.
In terms of getting involved in Twitter, one of the easiest ways to get started is simply to create your account and to start following people. Find people of interest, find the folks that are on this podcast, see who else they're following. That gives you a good introduction. And one of the nice things about Twitter is you can just lurk for a while. You don't necessarily have to dive into the pool. You can kind of stick your toe into the pool and look around and see what the lay of the land is. And then as you get more comfortable, you can start responding to things that people say, or you can start curating content and tweeting out links to things that you think are fantastic. There are a lot of ways to sort of ease into the pool. The other thing is there are some really good
primers on how to use Twitter out there. Heather Logie on her Allies for Health blog has a wonderful Twitter 101 for surgeons that starts with hatch your egg, which means put up a picture of yourself, don't leave your egg up. But also explains what the hashtags mean and what a retweet is and what the Twitter handles look like and all of those kind of things. Because it is, I mean, really it's a bit of an anthropology experience, learning a different culture and a different way of interacting. And if you embrace it as something that you're just going to try, that it's part of you working on your own neuroplasticity, then it can really be a lot of fun.
Dr. Livingston, and, as the senior member of this group, can you speak a little bit about, how, you said you're a new member. What were some of the barriers to you getting on, and what have you learned in your brief time on?
Well, the only barrier was time. You know, there's, like all of us, actually the work at the journal is the busiest thing I've ever done, even more than academic surgery. So they just, you know, when I came to the journal, they tried to get me involved, and I just didn't have the time. But then once this appendicitis thing came through and I saw how important it was, I started devoting more time to it. So that was the barriers. What was the second part of your question?
What are some things that you've learned in your brief time on? Some tips and tricks you've had, were you a little nervous the first time you got into kind of a little bit of a back and forth, or, you know, what has your experience been like?
Nah, I wasn't nervous because, you know, I'm a surgeon. I love a good fight, so that wasn't a problem. And plus, you know, the fight was about the ProPublica website, which I think is very problematic, and I think the people who put it together, who I was arguing with, don't really know what they're doing. So that was, and I think it was a very public fight, and I think it was worthwhile because I think that also, as I was mentioning earlier about the need for feedback, I think it provided feedback for everybody to see from someone who thinks about the math and thinks about the statistics of what's wrong with what they were doing. And I think that discussion needs to be held, and it needs to be very public. So providing that sort of feedback is important. What impressed me about social media once I got into it was how many really important players are there and very active in it, and the vast amount of discussion, feedback, and conversation that there was. I was just blown away by the power of the communication and interactions.
Dr. Livingston, I'm dying with curiosity, as I'm sure some of our listeners are. Could you just briefly tell us what this debate with ProPublica was?
Well, there was two of them. The first one was when it first came out, I had looked at a group of surgeons who I supervised in the past and found that the one who, it was orthopedic surgeons, and the one who was considered the very best joint replacement surgeon in the city looked the worst on the ProPublica site, and I think that's because it doesn't adequately risk adjust. And so I tweeted that. I said, it's interesting that a guy of a collection of surgeons who I supervised, and I knew everything about their practice, and who someone I know is the best, looked the worst, suggests that this system is flawed. So the reporter who put this together went after me with a vengeance and said that I was wrong, I didn't know what I was talking about, that they're using real data, and I was using just anecdotes. And I said, no, it wasn't anecdotes. It happened to be at the VA. It happened to have NISQIP. I happened to have a lot of data on all these people. And then that actually got moved to a private email discussion, and then he asked me for a lot of details about what I knew about these surgeons, and I gave it to him, and then he dropped away. Then, a couple of days ago, there was a tweet going around about something somebody wrote about hospital accreditation systems being flawed, and I responded to the tweet and said, yeah, it's just like the ProPublica thing. It's also a very flawed system. And the same reporter went after me with a vengeance, saying, you know, we have all these experts, they all say that it's great, and you don't know what you're talking about. And I said, look, I've been a surgeon for 30 years, and I was a chief of surgery for 16 of those years. I supervised people for a long time, and I kind of have a sense for what works and what doesn't, and I know your system doesn't work. And then he said, so what would you do if, in the absence of our numbers that we're providing, what advice would you give for patients to pick surgeons? I said, well, talk to the primary care doc and find out what their experiences with those surgeons are. And then he came back and said, well, that's really a very subjective, flawed system. So I said, you know, your flawed system is somehow better than my flawed system. You're a reporter and I'm a surgeon. And then he quit. He gave up. And so, but again, this was all in Twitter. It was all very public. And I thought it was a very useful thing for everybody to hear us argue. And then they can take away with it, they can take away from it whatever it is they want to take away. But I think it's, again, that kind of discussion wouldn't have happened in the absence of social media. And I thought it was very useful.
Yeah, and that is great. And for all our listeners out there, if you want to start following Dr. Livingston and be able to experience these, we're going to actually, if you click on the icon on iTunes, it'll have our show notes. And in our show notes, we'll put the article, the blog about how to get started on Twitter, and we'll also put all the hashtags of all of our panel members here so you guys can immediately get involved with some of the giants in social media.
So I want to just go back in as we finish up a little bit and talk. Scott and Lillian, we can start with Scott. What are some things that you've learned and maybe some barriers that you found or tips and tricks that you've had in your time spent on social media?
I was actually just going to say I think what Ed's experience illustrates is one of the things that I learned along the way, a little bit the hard way, is that there are some people on social media who view the stakes a lot higher than we do. So for me, it's an interesting educational experience. It's a chance to interact with people. But for some people, it's a real link to their livelihood. And I think of journalists as being the best example. As Ed also alluded to earlier, for the publishing world, the online and social media presence has become a completely critical part of their ability to draw readership and draw revenue. And so if and when we question or interact with journalists who really view this as a core portion of their profession, you have to be prepared for the fact that they're going to take it really seriously. And I found it actually exhausting a couple of times when I interacted with these people, because I realized that they were just not going to give up and they were going to keep coming back to me when I was interested in a much shorter conversation than they were. So I learned that maybe a little bit the hard way.
Lillian?
My experience with social media has been extremely positive. I would say that there may be people out there who are a little intimidated, because there are, as Dr. Livingston said, some pretty big players, chairs of surgery, journal editors, et cetera, who are on Twitter, and it can be intimidating to reply or to engage in discussions with them. But I think even if you're what's called a lurker, you can learn so much from the discussions. And I think that although it does take time to engage in Twitter, it's time well spent, because the amount of content, expertise, et cetera, that you're exposed to, it would be very difficult to find that if you just got online, because you wouldn't even know what to search for. Whereas on Twitter, following certain people, you can learn a lot about what's going on in surgery today.
Well, that was a fantastic discussion from all of our panel members. And if you've heard the podcast before, we actually do this thing called the Final Five. And Dr. Steele wanted to make sure that we got the Final Five in. And we're going to do it a little different this time, where we ask each of our members one of the questions from the Final Five. This is just some fun questions to get to know our panel members a little bit better. And so, Dr. Cochran, we're going to start off with you. Do you listen to music in the operating room? And if so, what type of music?
I do, and my OR music rules are very simple, actually. They consist of no rap, no metal, no Britney Spears. And until the 1989 album came out, there was also a no Taylor Swift rule. But it reminds me too much of the 1980s pop that I was raised on, so the Taylor Swift moratorium has been lifted only for the 1989 album.
Our second question is for Dr. Regenbogen. Sir, do you have any hidden talents that you'd like to share with us?
A hidden talent. It's probably the ability to identify all of the relatively obscure songs from that same 80s period that Amalia is interested in.
That's fantastic. We're going to have Name That Tune at next year's ASCARS meeting. Number three. Lillian, Can you tell us about a really good trip that you have been on, one of your favorites?
I went to Borneo as an offshoot of a meeting they went to as part of the AAS to Kuala Lumpur, and I climbed a mountain and almost made it up there at sunrise, but a little late getting there, but it was pretty amazing.
Question number four, Dr. Livingston. If you didn't decide to become a surgeon, what is it that you have done?
If I had the eyes for it, I'd be a fighter pilot.
That's fantastic. And now we're going to go around the horn to pass this to every single person. We always end all of our talks with this, so we'll go around the horn. We'll start off with Amalia. If you could go back in time and talk to yourself on your first day of internship, what advice would you give yourself?
Wow. That the hard times will be finite.
That's fantastic. Scotty?
I think it would be, you know, you're going to have the hardest days and the best days of your life sometime in the next 3 or 4 years.
Lillian?
What comes to mind is one of my attendings said, all bleeding stops eventually, one way or another.
Tell me which one at the University of Washington. And Dr. Livingston.
Well, as I mentioned, I've been Dr. Freischlag's intern for 30 years, so I don't know what I would do differently or say differently apart from what I did, which was pick my friends carefully.
Well, that is sage advice. And again, we just want to thank everybody for having spent the time with us and given us a little bit of an introduction and some of the things that you've learned about social media, and we really look forward to hopefully following you all and learning from one another and just seeing how we can all get more interactive, not only with each other, but spread information and education. And most importantly, we, again, for this particular episode, we appreciate you taking the time to have us on Behind the Knife.
Thanks, Scott.
Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Fash is closed, and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.